We're dealing this evening with a weighty topic that we started last week. There's a lot of weighty topics in the Bible, but there aren't many more weighty than this issue of grieving. And the reason is because losses are a very real part of our lives. There's no way to avoid that. God designed us in a very meticulous way to heal physically when we're physically injured. And what I'm suggesting to you from the Scriptures is He designed us to heal emotionally, to heal over losses by His grace, where He's the one doing the healing. But in both instances, it takes time. There's a process. It has to be done correctly. And, of course, God brings the healing. The mountains in the distance are where we want to get to when we're grieving a loss. If you look at the image on the screen, the mountains in the distance are not a place where what you have lost is returned to you. The mountains in the distance are where the loss is a part of you but doesn't consume you, and you now live and function in a healthy manner even though there's been this loss. And the problem for us, the difficulty in what the Scriptures talk about is how we get to that point. There's a great valley, and I think in that valley where we go through this grieving journey, we face confusion, we face a multitude of emotions, fears, and we may face them all at the same time so that it's difficult to even process where we're at. Sometimes we call that shock. We just numb, just don't know where we're at. And you know, it takes time to get through that, and there's a temptation to say, well, what if I could just avoid the pain? And you can try to do that, and you can try to sink yourself deep enough in a bottle or some activity or your work or whatever it may be. And what God's saying is that journey is not easy, but it's also not one you'll take alone. It's one I'll be with you, but that's the only way to the mountains. It's the only way back to a healthy place. It's the only way for healing. And I want to review a few of the things that we covered last week to sort of set the context for thinking about the book of Lamentations, this one place where God deals in the most detail with the issue of grieving and loss. There's all the places that deal with it, but no place in the amount of detail is the book of Lamentations. Last week, we put some definitions. We need definitions because we have words, and they don't mean the same thing to everybody. So if we're going to talk about grieving or mourning, I put a definition on it. The process whereby grief, that's all those emotions that you're flooded with, is a result of a loss. It's the process whereby the grief is expressed, and over time the person separates from the loss. And what I mean by that, you can be consumed by the loss, or you can separate from it in the sense that while it's never gone, it's a part of you, it's not the whole of you. And that's what we want. The second thing is we can grieve different kinds of losses. And I'm not going to go through the whole list like I did last week, but certainly there are physical losses, and the most serious are the loss of people, but lots of other physical losses that could require grieving. The loss of a job or the financial nest egg or an opportunity or even a dream. It can be a big thing to have had a dream that a lot of your life was shaped around a certain future you saw for yourself and it's been removed permanently. Lots of things can be grieved. But I do point out in this third bullet, we don't really grieve everything. If you grieved everything that you lost, you'd spend your whole life grieving. That's not the point at all. The point, rather, is there are those losses that they arrest you in your steps. They put you to a stop. They make you where your thoughts are consumed by it, like you're looking through a straw and all you see is the loss. Those have to be mourned, regardless of whether it's the loss of a person or something else. And so we have to mourn these losses so that God can bring healing to our emotional wounds. When Jesus said, "Blessed are those who mourn, for they'll be comforted," there's not a plan B. Blessed are those who avoid the pain, they'll be comforted. He never said that. You see, for him to say, "Blessed are those who mourn," he's talking of those who are dealing with the loss and facing it, not trying to somehow live in denial or walk around it. Christians mourn with hope, though. Not just any hope, resurrection hope. We have a different kind of hope. We're in, as the writer to Hebrews calls it in chapter 2, we're sort of in a place right now where we look forward to the world to come. And in the world to come, all those in Christ who have passed away are there. and we're going to be there. And so there's, as I think of it, as a great family reunion where a lot of the things we've lost, we'll have comfort from that. I'm saying we get them all back, but we'll have comfort from that, but the people we will get back. You think about that book of Job. The man lost everything. At the end of the book, everything got replaced to him twofold except one thing. You remember what he lost that never got replaced? Children. Why? They were never really lost to begin with. Right? Because there's a future where his children and him are united, the family reunion. So we have a resurrection hope. And Paul would tell the Thessalonians, comfort one another with these words. It won't take away all the pain of the loss, but there's hope in the midst of dealing with the pain of the loss. So those are some things from last week. I want to focus for a bit on the book of Lamentations and how we deal with grieving. Then I want to focus on how we help others. Because that's an important part of this. It's not just, what about me when I have a loss? What about the other person, your brother or sister in Christ, when they have a loss? What will you do? What are your obligations? Lamentations, and I want to mention a few technical things. I mentioned this last week, but it'll help us understand. First of all, an acrostic. An acrostic is typically a poem, but every line starts with a different letter, usually in order. So, for example, you might go from A to Z, and you would have a line of the poem for A, B, C, all the way through Z. The first four chapters of Lamentations are acrostics. That's written in Hebrew, so they don't go from A to Z. They go from Aleph, the first letter of the alphabet, to Tav, 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet. First two chapters, you'll notice, have 22 verses. The third chapter has 66. And it is three times as long. In essence, instead of having one line of the poem for the letter A, it has three. It's tripled them up. Then the fourth chapter is much, much shorter, much more terse. The fifth chapter is not an acrostic at all. It's the only one that's entirely a prayer. And it's sort of organized this way. Jewish mindset was whatever's in the middle is sort of the crescendo of the story. A lot of the Psalms are written that way. You don't always see it in the English, but it sort of has a middle verse that's like the critical part. When you read the first five books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, we skip that sometimes. Wait a second, that's the crescendo. Numbers, Deuteronomy, why is it the crescendo? This is the book that talks about how you come and worship God, how you come do business with God so that you may have atonement, read Leviticus 4 through 6, from sins. It's the high point. It's the place where all the feasts are talked about. In Lamentations, chapter 3 is the high point, right in the middle. It's why it's longer, and we'll see what's special about it when we get there in a minute. But that's the idea. And you say, well, why is it an acrostic? So it's artistic. Well, it's not just that. The grieving process, if we can call it that, isn't 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I'm done. But it has to be from A to Z. There has to be a finish marker. And what you see in the acrostic is a couple of things. The idea that we're going to grieve in its totality. We're going to deal with the loss in its totality. The A to the Z, the Aleph to the Tav. But something else is going to happen too. And that's going to be there's movement between Lamentations 1 through 5. It's not all distinct. There's overlap. There's repetition. You read the whole book in one sitting. It's not that long. Some repetition. All of chapter 5 is a prayer, but chapter 1 has a prayer. Every chapter talks about the losses again and goes through them. But there's movement. The tone, the words, things change. The process of grieving won't be five steps and you're done. It's going to be a step forward and a half a step back. And all these things and Lamentations sort of, they're going to work together. But it's not as discreet and clean as we may want, because that's the reality. And the people of the community that were left after Babylon had come in and destroyed the community, they needed to articulate out loud their losses. And Lamentations, I think, by Jeremiah the prophet, because he lived through this and was left behind, I think it was given to them as a way of helping them grieve, so that they would, as a community, articulate their losses. Cultures grieve in different ways. The ancient cultures, and even through today in the Middle East, will tear the clothes. If you see someone confronted with a great loss in the Middle East, a friend standing by will rip their shirt for them. And they may sit in sackcloth in the Bible and ashes and all that. We don't do that the same way, but there's something to this, a physical, visible outpouring of grief. And you see that in Lamentations. You see that as you move through here. But there's movement in the crescendos, chapter 3, and we'll see that. Well, I'm not going to belabor Lamentations 1, but just to review, what I suggested before is that you have to fully contemplate the loss. There's a lot of ways where we can get consumed with perhaps the circumstances that led to the loss, especially if we feel guilt. We can feel guilt because we, in fact, were to blame for the loss in some way. A person rolls the car back in the driveway and hits a child, and there's some blame there, and they can get consumed by that regret and those emotions of guilt. And that will cause bitter tears. But they're not mourning the loss, it's the circumstances. And in a lot of ways, that can happen. And if anything, what Lamentations 1 just really puts to us is it's a pouring out of the emotions, a contemplation of not just the loss of the person, or in the case of Lamentations 1, the people in the city, but all that that entails. Those beautiful feasts that happen three times a year won't happen anymore. It says in Lamentations 1 that the roads leading to Jerusalem, the roads cry out bitterly. And so it's not real organized. It's beautiful language, but it's just all there, just the cluster of everything. It's the contemplation of the loss. You have to do it. That's part of the valley. And if you've lost a person, you contemplate next week and next year and 10 years from now with their absence. And you contemplate a lot of things involved and connected to their absence. And it's hurtful. But in this process, we start to synthesize. We start to pull things together. And when you get to Lamentations 2, there's a subtle change. And that is, the author makes it very, very personal. That is, I'm not standing on the outside like a scientist looking at the loss and making notes very carefully and methodically about what's happened. At first, I'm just flooded with it all. But I have to be the one feeling the loss. It has to be very personal to me. You'll see this in Lamentations 2. And I want to be real clear here. I've said it before. I'm not living Lamentations 1, and then I'm done with it, and now I'm Lamentations 2. There's just sort of some movement. But I'm going to be there for a while if it's a person, a close person to me. I'm going to be there for a while. But it's going to get very personal in chapter 2. Let me read a few of the verses of chapter 2, and you'll get a sense for the way in which it's personal. First of all, they had some guilt in this loss because God sent prophets like Jeremiah that said, don't do this, and they did it anyway, and then the Babylonians came. And so you see this in chapter 2, verse 1. How hath the Lord covered the daughter of Zion with a cloud in his anger? The daughter of Zion is the city of Jerusalem and the inhabitants there. Now it's very personal. This is what God did to me. And it's being felt in a personal way. He's cast down from heaven unto the earth the beauty of Israel and remembered not his footstool in the day of his anger. Now, his footstool. You remember there was a piece of furniture, if you want to call it that, inside the temple called the Ark of the Covenant. It had these angels above it, the cherubim. And God was viewed as manifesting physically between the cherubim with his feet upon the mercy seat. That's what it's talking about. It says that he's remembered not his footstool. He's remembered not mercy in this day. It was the worst onslaught they had ever seen in Jerusalem. God seemingly held nothing back. And so they say he forgot the footstool. The Lord hath swallowed up all the inhabitants of Jacob. He hath not pitied. He hath thrown down in his wrath the strongholds of the daughter of Judah. And he hath brought them to the ground. He hath polluted the kingdom and the princes thereof. Now fast forward a little. We won't go through the whole thing. But listen to verse 11. Very personalized. Mine eyes. My eyes do fail with tears. The pouring out of emotions. My bowels. The bowels in the ancient world were thought of your seat of emotions. It's all being poured out. My bowels are troubled. My liver, again, not thinking of the organ so much, but it's again, thought of as a source of emotions. My liver is poured out upon the earth for the destruction of the daughter of my people. It's mourning the loss of tens of thousands who were killed when the Babylonian armies came through. And my liver is poured out upon the earth for the destruction of the daughter of my people, because the children and the sucklings, that's little bitty infants, swoon in the streets of the city. And as you read all the Lamentations, you'll see that famine always follows war, and famine hit here. And all I'm saying is, if there's any movement between the Lamentation in the first chapter and the one in the second chapter, it's become less loss under observation and more loss felt and realized on an individual personal level. That hurts. That's why I said it's a valley before you get to the mountains. And if we want to avoid and go in denial, we're not going to get to a healthy place. But this is hurtful. And yet Jeremiah knew, by the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, he had to take the remnant that remained after this onslaught through this Lamentation. But there's hope. Listen to some things from the third chapter. This is the longest chapter, and it has 66 verses. And I want to start with verse 1. This one's striking because I think at this point, the prophet Jeremiah, who himself has personally suffered, God hasn't judged him, and yet you cannot be in this city as it's been destroyed and not suffer. And Jeremiah speaks in the first person in Lamentations 3. He says, I am the man that has seen affliction by the rod of his wrath. Very, very personalized. We might say, well, that's duplicative of chapter 2. Yeah, they all overlap, but there's movement. But it's very blunt. I am the man, he says. He speaks for others, and he articulates it in a way that maybe they can't, but he's their voice in this moment, in this hour of need. I am the man that has seen affliction by the rod of his wrath. He hath led me and brought me into darkness, but not into light. This is a valley. You see it in the language. It's a very dark place where he feels that God has brought him here, and he's still there in this dark place. Surely against me is he turned. He feels that God is against him. He turneth his hand against me all the day. My flesh and my skin hath he made old. He hath broken my bones. This isn't literal, but there's a feeling of physical pain that is often associated with emotional pain. And Jeremiah experiences this. He says, he, referring to God, hath builded against me and compassed me with gall and travail. He hath set me in dark places as they that be dead of old. What do you need in a dark place? A little bit of light. Go up to verse 21. The centerpiece of Lamentations is chapter 3. And the centerpiece of chapter 3 begins in verse 21 and 22. Even through all this remembering, as he goes through all the afflictions he's personally experienced, there's one thing he can say that a non-believer can never say. It's in verse 21. This I recall to my mind. In the midst of the flood of all the loss, this I recall, therefore have I hope. It is of the Lord's mercies that we are not consumed, because his compassions fail not. He begins to even in the midst of the hurt, to see a light in a very dark place, to remember that I'm really not alone in this. And why? Because God will fix it all? Not quite that. Because he has something he knows about who God is, that makes a difference. And look at what he says about God's mercies. Verse 23, they're new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness. And we have that in a song. Why would it matter that they're new every morning? Because when you're mourning a deep loss, there are going to be a number of days. It's not over in a week. You may stop hearing from people after a week or two that had called every day for a while, but you're not out of that valley yet. And he says, but God's mercies are new every morning. If they weren't, you'd get stuck in the valley. You'd never make it across. And he says, God's mercies are new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness. He's talking about the character of God. You know, if you don't know much about God, this won't be very reassuring. It's the mature knowledge of who God is, of his character, his goodness, his faithfulness, His loving kindness, His being in control, like we've been talking about in the messages on Esther, His unseen hand in the circumstances, even in the darkest hour. Verse 24 says, "The Lord is my portion." It's who He is and our relationship to Him that gives that beginning of hope that we can come out of the tunnel. He says, "Saith my soul, therefore will I hope in Him. The Lord is good unto them that wait for Him, to the soul that seeketh Him. It's good that a man should both hope and quietly wait for the salvation of the Lord." He's not talking about his destiny. He's talking about the healing and comfort from the physical loss. And I think ultimately he sees a future where Jerusalem will no longer lie in ruins, because God made promises in the Old Testament about that. So this is sort of the crescendo where he has hope. And if we didn't have hope, we'd never make it through this process. Yet even in chapter 3, it's full of sorrow. Full of sorrow. Chapter 4 is much shorter. When you look at 4, you'll notice it's again 22 verses, but just in terms of length, much shorter than chapter 1 or 2. And I would say it's more focused, it's more measured in its language, more synthesized, more orderly, more, to me, it's the lamentation after you've been in the valley long enough that things aren't all confused and jumbled. They start to sort of range themselves, where you can kind of identify this loss and this one, and get a little bit more of your head around what has happened and maybe what is God doing with this. And you see this in chapter 4. I'll read a few verses. If you look in verse 1, "How has the gold become dim? How has the most fine gold changed?" What he's talking about is the temple. If you look at how the temple was built, that Solomon built, most of it was covered with gold. It was a sight to behold, and it was at an elevated position, so you could see its grandeur from a distance. It was one of the wonders of the world, even by those who don't believe. They had to recognize what a beautiful place it was. It was also a target. You're an invading army. That's money on that hill. And they thought no one could ever take it. Everybody thought no one could ever take it, because God said, as long as I'm here, no one's going to take it. If you read the scriptures in Ezekiel. Once the people finally said, we'll not listen to Jeremiah, we'll not listen to Ezekiel, God's presence is seen as leaving the temple. And the moment he leaves, Nebuchadnezzar comes in. This beautiful place, he says in verse 1, "The stones of the sanctuary are poured out in the top of every street." The temple was built with huge stones, and they're just laying around in the street as it was completely dismantled. The precious sons of Zion, he's already moved to the next loss. Not just the temple is gone, but the sons of Zion, the young men, he says, comparable to fine gold. They were of such value. We have to contemplate the value of the loss. He's more methodically moving through it. He says, "How are they esteemed as earthen pitchers?" Their value is more than gold. But when the soldiers came, their lives had no more value than those little cheap clay pictures that you get at the Home Depot. And now they lie broken across the street. Every tell, T-E-L, the big sand dune you'll see over an ancient city, as the archaeologists get into the tells, what they always find are the little potsherds, little piece of the clay pottery, the broken lives of those who died here. And he speaks of that. He says in verse 3, "Even the sea monsters draw out the breast. They give suck to their young ones." He's talking about even these dumb animals in the sea understand how to take care of their young. But he says, "But the daughters of my people have become cruel like ostriches in the wilderness." The old view that ostriches would betray their own offspring, their own eggs. And what's happened in the famine is people are unwilling to feed their own children. He sees this tremendous hurt, but he sort of methodically moves through it. And verse 13, I think, is the key verse. It's the focal point. He says, "For the sins of her prophets and the iniquities of her priests that have shed the blood of the just in the midst of her." What was the sin of her prophets? They said, peace. When Jeremiah said, war's coming. Jeremiah said, when the war comes, you've got to give up. Throw up the white flag. Surrender to Babylon. But the false prophet said, you can win. And they tried to win, and the city got taken and destroyed in a way that didn't have to happen. And that's why he gets there. The sins of her prophets, and the iniquities of the priest. But then in chapter 5, it becomes just prayer. No more acrostic. No more working from A to Z through the pain yet again. It really becomes a picture of someone that's a lot closer to the mountains than the beginning of the journey, as they can really offer a much fuller prayer to God, showing that they're getting beyond the loss in some way. And he starts off, remember, O Lord, what has come upon us. Consider and behold our reproach. This is a prayer for God to have mercy, to turn things around. Things won't go the way they were before. I mean, those people died. They're gone. But for God to come in with mercy and to turn things around, he says, our inheritance is turned to strangers, our houses to aliens. Verses 15 and 16, the joy of our heart has ceased. That's what happens when you're in that valley. The joy is gone. It's robbed of you. Our dance is turned into mourning. The crown has fallen from our head. Woe unto us that we have sinned. There's really a full realization that what's happened here was what God said would happen. But in this prayer, there's this prayer, and you see it in verse 19. Thou, O Lord, remainest forever, thy throne from generation to generation. You and you alone have the power to bring healing to us, to this people, to turn these circumstances around. And it is, we're grieving. Ultimately, that's the case. As you're through the valley, that God and God alone is the one that can comfort the brokenhearted, bind up their wounds, as the scripture says. Verse 21 says, turn thou us unto thee, O Lord, and we shall be turned. Renew our days as of old. Restore us. Restoration. So this is the lamentations. We'd all wish that these things have discreet and easy steps. And I think a lot of counterfeit preaching goes along that way. Here's three steps to fix this, five steps to fix that. Lamentations isn't it like that. It's a place where you dwell for a while and then come out of the other side because there's movement there, but with hope and with prayer. And I want to think about now how do we grow through grief? We're going to face grief, but how do we grow through grief? So we'll go through a few of these points quickly. First of all, grief destroys your pride and self-reliance. You come to a place of realizing you can't fix it. Only God can heal us. Only God can bind emotional wounds. And Lamentations moves us to the prayer of chapter 5, a prayer for God to do the fixing or the healing, not for me. Not God, show me how to fix it. God, will you fix it? We grow in reliance on God. We have to. And we move from why me to how can God use this creatively? How can God show me purpose in the pain? And I think of it as an example, and some of you have heard of her, of a young Joni Erickson Tada who would injure herself in an accident where she's paralyzed from the neck down. And if you listen to her life story, and you really should if you've not, she would go through a long period of, you know, why am I alive? And what purpose can there be? And why did God let this happen to me? And all those sorts of thoughts that you'll read it right in the Revelation. Same thoughts that they had. Why? And through due course of time, through a grieving over what had happened, she comes out on the other side and she would see God use what had happened, her loss of the ability to use her arms and legs, her confinement to a wheelchair, to help her have a ministry to others who are in like situation. So she's had the ability now to speak to tens of thousands of people around the world. And she does artwork with a brush in her mouth. I had a student similar to that, one of the same challenges in a wheelchair. He calls himself the rolling preacher. It hadn't held him back. It's helped him reach a group of people that identify with the rolling preacher on that wheelchair. And he ministers to them. She found purpose in the pain. I don't know if we'll always find all the answers we want, But God does have a way of using what's happened in our lives. It's become a part of us, and yet He uses it creatively to help us minister to others. J. Vernon McGee always said a pastor has to suffer first before he can minister to people. And there's a lot of truth in that. And our pain can become a launching pad as we work through it to help others that have a like need. God uses trials. I'll read something from James, a familiar passage. We won't dwell there, but you just need to understand that more than any other place in our lives, it's the trials that God uses to grow us. And as we mourn a loss and we grow through faith and go on this journey through grief, God grows us. If we're not grown by these trials, they'll hold us down. They'll hold us down forever. But James chapter 1, verse 2 says, "My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into diverse temptations or trials." This isn't the person who says, "I'm just waiting for the next piano to fall on me, the next job loss." But it's the person that says, "I recognize that everybody has bad things happen to them. But I also recognize that Hebrews 12 says, God uses His training program, His discipline, His training for your profit to be partakers of His holiness." See, and so we see that, and that's what James is saying here. He says, knowing this, this is the reason you can count it joy, that the trying of your faith works patience, or we'd say endurance, but let patience or endurance have her perfect work, that you'll be perfect. That means mature, entire, wanting nothing. It's God's growth program. And so somewhere in the mix of how God grows us as His children, the grieving process is a part of that, because that's one of the trials we face. Let's talk a little bit, as I bring this to a close, about how we can help others. I want to read Romans 12:15. This is such a good verse. Paul tells the Romans, "Rejoice with them that do rejoice, and weep with them that weep." Now, if you're going to weep with them that weep, a few things have to happen. One is you've got to be around those people and be involved in their lives. If you're an island, even if you go to this church and you're an island, you're not going to weep with anybody. You've got to get into their lives. You've got to know what's happening. You've got to be a good listener, a better listener than a talker. And weeping with them means that you're sort of shouldering a little of that burden. You can hear their pain, and you can't take it away, but you can be there. He doesn't say go weep at your house. He says weep with them. Apart from them. Just think about that. It's that, and we'll say some more about this. You can't fix it. You can weep with them. 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 3 and 4. "Blessed be God, even the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies." That sounds like something out of Lamentations 3. His mercies are new every morning. "And the God of all comfort, who comforteth us in our tribulation, that we may be able to comfort them which are in any trouble by the comfort wherewith we ourselves are comforted of God." See, that's the point. That was my point of with Joni Erickson Tata. How can I take what I've gone through and minister more effectively to someone else and try to give them some comfort? Well, some things here we can do to help others. First, pray for them. We've got to pray for people. We have a responsibility for the well-being of those around us, particularly in this body of believers here at Northwest, not only physically, but spiritually and emotionally, and we can pray for people. We can recognize stages of grief, and I'm not going to get real far into this, but you understand there's some things that go through a person's mind, especially as they lose a loved one, and it tends to start with just the shock of the event. And the shock of the event is people don't know how to feel. Everything's confusion, maybe even just a numbness emotionally, physically. Shock, they can't move, they can't operate. After that usually is denial. Denial looks like just disbelief. I'm still waiting on the phone because I know she's going to call on the phone the next call, and it's like, no, they're gone, but I'm still waiting on the phone call. That kind of thing, the disbelief, the bargaining. You know, if I'd only taken him to the doctor a few days sooner, this wouldn't have happened. You start to bargain in your mind how we could move history around and make a different outcome happen. And then there's sort of the anger. It's not fair. You know, a lot of people get stuck here, especially when someone else has caused the loss of their loved one. And certainly there should be justice in our courts for those who have, by criminal conduct, taken a life. But you can get consumed here. You can get consumed by the civil lawsuit you filed and a bunch of different things, and you don't get to where you really need to be, which is after the shock and the bargaining and the denial and the anger, the mourning. Actually assessing the loss, actually working through it, and then ultimately a goal of acceptance or integration where you're able to function healthy. So what can we do? Well, we recognize where people are at, and we can't say, well, you can't be here, you need to be here. But just be understanding. You know, because when they're in anger or disbelief, they're not going to say and think the way we might want them to say and think, and that sort of thing. But what we can try to do is get people to help them focus on their loss, because that's not natural. What's natural is to get people not to focus on their loss, because we'd rather cheer them up. We'd rather try to put a smile on their face, but you can't do that. People have to focus on their loss and not the circumstances. We start where they're at, and we try to move them toward mourning the loss. If someone's died, talk about that person. Share positive memories. Because I think what's natural is a few things. We'll address them here just briefly, but maybe to say nothing. We just don't know what to say, so we say nothing. But that comes off as sort of uncaring. The person has passed away, but if we truly believe there's hope for the future, we can talk about that person. Offer advice only if asked. That will rarely happen. Someone may ask you advice. Well, what do I do? This has happened. I mean, who do I call? Like, they may not know how to call the funeral home and make those sort of arrangements. There's the things that must be done. But don't offer them advice about how to fix things, because you can't fix it. Someone has lost their life, and you can't fix it. You need to be very careful about offering advice. Do what must be done, as I mentioned, maybe helping with cleaning or food or phone calls, funeral arrangements. Here, the place where we fail the most often is being there for the long haul. We're real good at being around people, even smothering them for a few days, and then sort of falling away. And it's hard. We're busy and all that. But if someone loses a loved one, what I mean by being there for the long haul, we need to be there for however long it takes. And we should expect that will be months, perhaps years, to try to be there in some way to weep with those who weep. Let me list quickly what not to do, and we'll bring it to a close. Don't preach or try to cheer them up. It was just their time. Well, God needed another angel. And that sounds stupid. But you want to hear some stupid, you listen to some comments made at funerals to the people who are grieving. I mean, just stupid stuff. I'll give you a couple of examples here. I'd met a young man who was another lawyer who had a child die after 10 days or so. And the words he kept getting from people for years was an explanation, generally of what him or his wife had to have done wrong for this to happen. This is like he's surrounded by Job's comforters. And these are the people at church, the ones that are supposed to have help for him, that are supposed to have hope. And he's hearing how it's his fault. People get lots of answers about what caused the loss. I can remember at Berea, we'd had a visiting missionary who came up with an invitation, and I just, you know, I didn't know what to expect, but he came up to me. He got on that mission field, and his wife and daughter were taken real early on in their ministry, and they were dead. And he was consumed by trying to find out the answer to why that had happened, and a lot of people had given him the idea that God would give him that answer. And here's the reality. He probably won't. And the mourning has to happen, not the being consumed with those answers. But you could go to any of a number of perhaps well-meaning teachers and preachers and other Christians, and they all had an answer. But it wasn't a real answer. But they have an answer, and it's hurtful. We need to not cheer people up. That's not what we're trying to do. We do need to help people mourn. We need to help them mourn the loss if there's a way to do that, a way to be present with them so they don't feel to be completely lonely during that time. Don't explain why God allowed the death. Don't avoid the grieving person. I don't know what to say, and I'm scared I'll say the wrong thing, so I'll hide from them. That's not very loving. Take some risk for another person to help them, to love on them. Don't expect them to just get over it by a set point in time. That's not realistic. And don't forget other family members. Sometimes we kind of see the person who's lost somebody, and we forget that he wasn't just a husband. He was a father. He was a brother. He was a son. And so there's a large sort of group of people who need our attention and our love in that time. Well, with that, I just want to say, obviously, a difficult topic, but what we should be about is first understanding that we have to grieve losses and not be consumed by them. It's not easy, but God promises He'll comfort us, He'll heal us. And we certainly, as a church family, have to reach out and help other people during their time as much as we're able and pray for them and pray for God to give us wisdom to do that as well. Thank you.